coming, enjoy your day in the Capitol. Why don't you let them leave? Good luck with graduation, Sharon.
Job hunting.
Well, Steve, maybe.
No. You're not recruiting.
Go ahead, Steve.
So if Congress makes those changes, which would basically reduce the record-keeping required and allow a little bit more depreciation on luxury cars, if Congress adopts those, then that would also become part of our law, effectively. And then a lot of the other changes is to try to take those big decisions and changes and make them fit Oregon law. A reconnect doesn't always give you a glove on the hand treatment right away, so that's what a lot of the other provisions try to do. We had an innocent spouse rule that would be liberalized as the feds did. The feds made some provisions in how bonds would be taxed, but those would not apply to bonds that the feds do not tax, some of the exempt bonds, but those bonds and interest from those bonds would be taxed by Oregon, so that they wanted to make sure that there was the same treatment. There was a provision to adopt a payment in kind tax treatment for farmers, which was not part of the 84 Tax Reform Act, and the code provisions, so that those would be used for farmers in determining when PIP income would actually be reported.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Trahan.
Is that different than the Fed? Is this not a reconnect issue? Do I understand you correctly? The payment kind.
It is a reconnect issue in terms of the farmer recording his income for state purposes the same as federal. Right. Although it was not part of the Tax Reform Act, it was a separate provision.
Mr. Chair. Representative Klein?
Can you give a little bit longer explanation of what that is?
Yeah, and let me tell the committee, Steve is going to go through and just hit the highlights exactly the way he's been doing. I think his pace is just right. If you have any questions and want him to go into any greater detail at this time on any item in the summary, please ask the question.
Steve? Mr. Chair.
If all right?
If keeping pace is important, that's
no,
fine.
No, it isn't. Keeping the pace is important unless you have a question, and then we can digress.
Okay.
Steve?
This was payment in kind?
Yeah.
Okay. For the PIP payments to farmers, they do not have to report that immediately if they do not, when the federal government gives them grain as payment in kind, if that's not sold right away, they do not have to report that as income, the value of the grain. So that if they keep the grain, sell it later, or they feed it to animals and so on, it's the final sale that triggers when that has to be reported as income.
Steve?
Okay, there are certain corporate tax preference items of which the feds did allow a 15% reduction. They were going to change that to a 20% reduction in the tax preference item, which tended to increase corporate taxable income. The committee decided to not follow that action at the federal level and allow the full deduction of the tax preference item. The reason for that is because the state does not have any kind of minimum tax and the feds do. The number five on the debt financed portfolio stock, if a corporation invests in stock of another corporation as not part of its group of corporations that have more than one involved, for investment purposes, then 85% of those dividends are not taxable beginning in 1985 when we have the same treatment as feds. The feds changed their treatment of that so that if any of that investment is financed by debt, then that reduces the 85% of the dividends received that are not taxable. So that this mitigates the situation where a corporation borrows money to buy stock to receive the dividends and get 85% of that exempt, and it can also take the interest expense on their borrowed money and take that as a deduction also. So it's trying to reduce that kind of transaction. They would also have a provision where any FISC or DIS transactions are ignored for tax purposes. Again, make sure that FISC are included because that's a federal change that takes effect, and when we use a consolidated reporting again in 86, we want to continue the treatment that we have had for DIS in terms of any of that income being taxed. The FISC is a foreign corporation, but in that, so that it would not be taxed from that standpoint, but any transactions between that foreign corporation and the domestic corporation would be ignored as far as the domestic corporation's taxable income. There is a exempt income now for the permanently or totally disabled. The feds changed that to a tax credit, and the tax credit would be calculated the same as the elderly tax credit. So instead of up to $5,200 of income being exempt, that would be converted to a credit. The other kinds of simplification and uniformity changes that were made was to update the child care credit so that we're now tied to 1979 federal law. We would use the current federal law on child care credits, and that's more liberalized in terms of the expenses that can be taken. Same with the elderly care credit. We're tied to the old 79 federal provisions. Let's update that to the current provisions, and again, the feds in the meantime have liberalized the amount of income that can be used for that credit. The last session had a provision in the law that would not allow a non-itemizer charitable contribution as the feds allowed. The subcommittee decided to go ahead and let that begin for 1985. Since it was the last session, only eliminated that for 83 and 84.
Mr. Chairman.
Sam Hostica.
Do we have revenue impacts on each of these items, or is...
Not individually, no. There's some overall revenue items that we can, that I can show you.
Okay. Mr. Chairman,
basically,
can you refresh my memory on this charitable contributions? I recall we had some testimony a while ago on that issue, and I'm not clear on what that testimony was, but I thought we were talking around $15 million.
That's correct.
On this item alone?
Yes.
Just on that's probably one of the larger items.
Individual items, yes.
Individual items. And if there is a particular item that we really need a revenue estimate on, you can gin one up, can't you?
Yes. Try to. This has already been taken into account in the current law budget forecast.
Mr. Chairman?
Hoskins.
I guess that just for my own understanding of it, those items that are of that magnitude, I would hope the staff could flag those for us just so we could be aware of them. You know, things that are very small but over $10 million at least, I think would be what I would consider a magnitude that we ought to be looking at.
And we're definitely going to go through each of these in detail. When we get into the work session, we'll march through these to where the committee understands the individual item and understands the ramifications and the alternatives, and we'll march through the same work that the subcommittee went through probably much more quickly than the subcommittee did, and they did all that work for us. But
Mr. Chairman, some of these also go the other way. They also generate revenue. Mr. Chairman, if I might, our whole focus, and I think the 5 or 6 million of the Department of Revenue as well as the CPA and the subcommittee was conformity and simplicity. That was a thing we were trying to focus on. Obviously, there were some policy decisions, but we kept thinking simplicity, conformity. Obviously, we backed off on some of them. We just couldn't do it. Some of these will create revenue. I can't remember what the budget, the dollar amount that's in the governor's budget for the 80 million?
16.
16? 20 here, 20.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
Steve?
We also decided to use the federal AGI definition when a limitation, either on a deduction, primarily a deduction item, had to be calculated.
There's really no Oregon AGI in the statutes, and when Oregon law deviates from federal law, then that creates a problem as to what measure of AGI to use. So if you're calculating a standard deduction, for example, you would use the federal definition of adjusted gross income. The filing status for a resident, non-resident spouses was changed to conform to how we have the law now for non-residents filing that was passed out of committee. When one is out of, one is a non-resident, and you can only use the Oregon portion of the income to calculate the tax. So they file separately unless they elect to file joint, and also are filing joint on the federal level. Any interest paid or earned on excess contributions to an IRA or a TIER form above limits allowed for Oregon would not be taxed until distributed. Regulated investment companies, which are commonly known as mutual funds, would be able to deduct additional, not additional, but interest on bonds that Oregon taxes again, but not the feds, trying to cover both bases. Net operating losses for Oregon would be the same as federal, and then there was a provision to clarify when interest might have to be paid, the beginning date for it. If a corporation is set up specifically to hold title to property owned by an exempt organization, then that corporation would not have to be taxed on that income as long as all of that was turned over to the exempt organization. Other minor corrections and clarifications, the feds changed the code number for definition of interest, wanted to correct that, wanted to clarify what kind of basis adjustment was necessary for differences between federal and state when assets were sold because of ACRS versus Oregon depreciation or whatever might attribute to that basis difference. Wanted to make sure that the deduction allowed corporations from making changes to buildings for access for the handicapped would only be the amount allowed and not both the federal and the state, so that the state deduction would only be taken if the feds happen to be less than the state. There was a small period from August 31, 82 to when we reconnected in 83, a window period there when the treatment of qualified stock purchases was different. This goes back and closes that window so that that small period is treated the same as in 83. There were several S-corporation provisions to clarify the flow through from the S-corporation to stockholders, and then a correction was allowed on 81 and 82 returns when some S-corporations ended up paying tax because of the ACRS depreciation difference that they had to add in, but then could not subtract back out to get to a zero income. We also put in a provision that allowed the corporations to go ahead and take an income loss or deduction that they might otherwise be precluded from taking because it was allowed in 82 and was to be carried over to 83, but then the 83 reconnect changed the situation for them and would have not allowed it. So if there's that kind of situation, they would still be able to go ahead and use that. There was also some clarification on the special session law dealing with the Water's Edge unitary provisions to, since there's been more time now to look at those, to make some changes in the language for clarity primarily. And then there was some issues that the committee wanted to, subcommittee wanted to come back to the full committee with. One was the first, the non-itemized charitable contribution.
If I might, Mr. Chairman.
Representative
Burrows. We really need to focus on these because we spent, as you know, weeks, but these are the ones that we really need the advice and counsel of the full committee. I didn't mean to interrupt Steve, but I wanted to really concentrate on these.
Appreciate the way you've done this. You've really targeted major issues.
Mm-hmm. Another was a suggestion was made that instead of having the current state interest and dividend exclusion, to adopt just the current federal dividend exclusion.
Nothing for us?
Well, we might, could I elaborate just a moment on that one? I think it was Representative Bill Rutherford, who's now the state treasurer, who works so hard to say you could have the first 200 or 400 on a joint account, the first 200 or 400, whatever it be, interest would not be taxable. And the federal government has lowered that amount, and they only include interest, or excuse me, they only include, they only allow dividends. And so I think the committee was split, or did we decide just to come back to, it would undo that whole provision. And some of us think they were capital poor, and it was a good idea, so anyway, it's a wonder flag.
Steve?
The other was to come back and look at some language that was proposed to the subcommittee on a further unitary clarification item, so that it was an opportunity for the full committee to look at that. And then lastly, the whole question of ACRS was not resolved by the subcommittee. So the full committee will have to look at that issue in its entirety.
Madam Chair.
Representative McCracken?
Could you elaborate on just how serious the inability of the subcommittee was to deal with the ACRS issue?
We were so busy dealing with, this is what came from the, all the CPAs within the department divided in a manner, that we recognized very early there was a split in the subcommittee, and we didn't deal with it. We didn't take the time because we were so busy with other items, and it would, we would have had to go through the whole thing over again, so we chose not to spend time on it, knowing that we could not resolve it, and that was with the chair's sanction, that we not spend a lot of time on it.
Mr. Chairman, definitely that was a decision that was sub, and they presented that to me, and I certainly concurred that it sounds like that's a discussion that might be best made in full committee. Representative Hugo?
Before I have looked for the discussion, three of them, in my opinion, are policy questions that the full committee has to address. Representative Hoska raised the non-identical charitable. That's a $15 million policy investment question. The interest and dividend, do we want to encourage individual savers and reward them by exempting a certain portion of their interest earnings, or do we want to adopt the federal program, which is no interest exemption, and reward corporate investors through dividend exclusion? Number three, water's edge, no one understands it.
Except for the department.
Maybe Representative Hamlet knows, but it's very confusing. And what we adopted in special session is now trying to be clarified. There's no policy question there as far as, I don't think there's a policy question. It's like, it's just a matter of what's going on.
Yeah, that's right.
The ACRS policy question, even though it's budgeted in the federal, in the governor's budget, with President Reagan presenting the tax simplification program of May, I guess this next one, no one's too sure what's going to happen to the federal ACRS. If we're going to reconnect for conformity and simplicity, we may be reconnecting to something that's not going to be there the day after we adjourn Sunny Dye.
Or we could connect to whatever and not know the dollar impact.
Well, we better tell Representative him in advance. We appreciate him being on the subcommittee, but with his legal and CPA background, he better be prepared on number three. You have to translate that from DOR talk to Revenue Committee talk. Representative Scone?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Do you have any specific plan in mind as to how to proceed in the discussion from this point? Today,
what I'd like to do is to go to the public hearing. We do have some people signed up to testify and would like to hear from the public. We do have 30 minutes, and my intention there would be to listen to public and then get to work session as quickly as possible. Probably not today, but it would be nice, frankly, if we could have a public hearing by the way today, so we could spend the rest of our reconnect time on in work session on the policy issues that we need to pursue.
The reason I was asking is that the third item that Bruce mentioned, the water's edge unitary clarification, I think is the one issue that we could not even really develop very good opinions on, because there's a basic fundamental question of, regarding the application of one principle that could either undo or
or maintain the unitary principle that we established, we thought we were establishing it in the special session. And so we need to hear from Jim Gaffney. He was not here last time when we talked about that, and maybe he can...
He's the first one to...
I think we really do understand it, but I'm having a difficult time making up my mind about whether we should do it.
Mr. Chair, if that's the case, or Madam Chair, if that's the case, lessen the obligation the chair has placed on Representative Hanlon to explain this concept.
Yes, I'm sure Jim Gaffney came today. We're open to hearing Jim Gaffney. You come forward.
Madam Chair, and Mr. Gaffney should be informed that the blackboard was sure useful in subcommittee.
Yes. We really appreciate all the time that you've spent with us, I'm sure.
He continues to be an education for me year after year, session after session.
Yes, sir.
Representative Scott?
I would like to ask Jim a question, I think, in order to get the discussion started. Maybe Representative Hanlon can help me with the question, but I think that we need to, first of all, have the step principle, I think it was called, explained, and then you could tell us how that affects the unitary principle and why then it threatens the relationships we thought we had previously established, that water's edge principle.
Okay. For the record, I'm Jim Gaffney with the CPA firm of Walter Anderson. I'm on the board of directors for the Oregon Society of CPAs. I've had an opportunity to talk to Elizabeth Stockdale with Justice, with Dave Eford, who was representing the CPAs at that work session. First of all, just to state our concern at the outset and our reason for suggesting this technical correction is that whatever the intent is to determine whether or not a unitary business exists, whether the intent is to look to worldwide activity and make that determination, or just look to domestic activity, or just look within the federal consolidated return, we think that that needs to be clarified. We aren't as married to the how as we are to that it be specified in the statute. We've talked to people in the Department of Revenue who feel that this needs to be clarified in the statute rather than by ruling. So that's why we've taken this course.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hanlon, Mr. Gaffney, so just so we clarify the issue you're talking about, the issue has nothing to do with whether unitary corporations exist beyond the water's edge. The issue solely has to do with whether you take into account transactions that occur beyond the water's edge that affect whether two corporations, for instance, within the United States are unitary in principle. Am I correct?
That's correct.
So we're not dealing with whether or not a foreign corporation is a part of the unitary group.
That's correct, Representative Hanlon.
Thank you.
So the step transaction analogy was, the way it started was I asked Elizabeth Stockdale what her interpretation was of the statute as it currently read. And her interpretation was that you looked within the consolidated group and looked for activities that would lead to a unitary business conclusion. And so my suggestion was to put that into the statute. At that time, Elizabeth raised some concerns, and she was concerned about gamesmanship that might occur and how to prevent that. And my suggestion to her was is that by adopting the federal tax laws by reference, we've also incorporated traditional interpretations, one of which would be a whole list of cases that where they have found step transactions or gamesmanship by doing things in 10 steps that are really one, that they'll collapse those and look at them as one. Now, since the in the work session, Elizabeth and I have had some work, some more, and there's some new language that's been put together with which I agree. I think accomplishes the same thing. There's been some words like a direct and indirectly incorporated, and it also it's been expanded to look at all domestic companies, whether they're in the federal consolidated return or not, if they're affiliated for unitary activities. And that would eliminate the gamesmanship that might go on a domestic basis, so that the only gamesmanship you might have at all would be beyond the water's edge, but then you would still have the directly or indirectly language that might overcome that. So my understanding, and I don't mean to speak for Elizabeth, but that she's comfortable with that. In fact, I believe that she's drafted it, and I've reviewed it, and I'm comfortable with it. But again, our purpose here is just simply to clarify something that we do believe is uncertain at this time, and is a key issue in the administration of our new water's edge or consolidated return approach to corporate filings.
Yes, Jim.
Same scheme.
Jim, with the new language, prohibit the determination of whether a step transaction existed in a domestic company or two domestic companies and a foreign company. I think the original language would have prevented us from determining whether or not a step transaction had occurred if a foreign company was involved. Does the new language change that, or does it still
hurt? Well, I think so. Elizabeth's concern was that the step transaction doctrine that's been developed judicially might not cover the situations that she was contemplating, whether they be foreign or domestic. And so given that, rather than argue that issue, which would continue to be argued if it's being argued now after this wording was implemented, we decided to try and come up with new wording that would avoid the possibilities of gamesmanship. And I think that the way the wording has been broadened, there's no possibility of gamesmanship on a domestic basis. And the only question I think would be with foreign, but I think this direct or indirect language, I mean, I don't know what other interpretation could be given to it, but I'm relying primarily on Elizabeth's interpretation with respect to that. My understanding is that she feels that that's adequate, and we're certainly comfortable with the language.
The new language that you prepared, since we had our long discussion at subcommittee on direct or indirect, would that allow the revenue department, if they had, if they suspected something that the step principle would be attributable or used in, to go beyond the water's edge to investigate?
Representative Heeman, I would have to defer to the Department of Revenue on that. I don't know what additional authorities it would give them. I'm not. My own understanding is that their authorities aren't limited to water's edge in terms of what they can audit. I think it's a question of resources to be able to do any kind of auditing beyond the state boundaries. My understanding is that they can do that. It's a question of being able to afford the cost of doing that kind of auditing.
But my question was beyond the United States boundaries, not the state boundaries.
I would put it in the same category. That my understanding is that they can go anywhere, but I don't pretend to be expert on that. I'm not sure what the extent of their authority.
So you can't answer the question as to whether the direct or indirect language would allow the Department of Revenue to investigate beyond the continental United States, or the United States.
Yes, Representative, that's correct.
Okay.
Just, Chair, further questions at this time, or Representative Scott?
Well,
to try to explain to the committee why this is important is that in the special session to pass the legislation that we did, I think all thought that we would not be going into the books of any foreign corporation to determine whether or not they belong to a unitary group, because foreign corporation would not be a company filing a part of a consolidated return. Correct me if I'm wrong on this. So we assumed that we'd solve the big problem, one of the big problems, of going into foreign companies' books to determine the relationship of transactions. The step theory, in effect, says that you can avoid establishing the identity of related firms, and therefore a unitary group, by perhaps going out of the United States to hide the transaction, maybe just a paper shuffle. And if they apply the step theory, which apparently is established well in law, that you should look beyond the obvious transaction to see what really occurred. Well, if the Department of Revenue is then, based on this theory, able to go to the foreign company and say, well, open your books, we want to see your corporate minutes,